You know, our life for the last couple of years has been the epitome of this. As you know, we struggled through a lot of events, including for ourselves the loss of a child, and then having Josiah. And then one of the funny things in our life is that every time my wife was pregnant, she began to pray, "Oh God, I would love to have twins," and that was kind of her prayer life every time she was pregnant. And then at my age of over 40, and my wife was years old, 22, and we found out we were pregnant again, which was rather interesting in and of itself, because we thought we were done, and we'd kind of made a decision, hey, we're not going to have any more children. Problem was that we never did anything official to solve that, and kept trusting in the sovereignty of God, and so I never forget sitting, you know, like I said, every time it was, "Oh God, give us twins," my wife began like falling on her face in the bedroom, crying out to God every night, "Oh God, not twins, not twins." And I'll never forget sitting in the office with the nurse doing the first ultrasound, and she's, you know, doing it and says, "Oh, what a, look there, there's a sweet little baby," and we're looking at a picture on the screen, and there it is, you can see the heartbeat and everything. And then this pregnant pause, haha. And then she looks at Heidi and goes, "Oh, sweetie, there's two in there." And my wife immediately bursts into tears. I mean, you know, her immediate reaction was, "Wah!" You know, we have wrestled with the fact that, you know, you kind of order your lives, you set things up, and it should work a certain way. And that was not in our plan. That was not the way we had ordered things and set things up. And so now our lives are defined by chaos, mayhem, lack of control. The amazing thing about having twins is that when they are up and running, they are never up and running in the same direction. We got a pool just this week for my birthday. I got a year older, and I'm not proud of that, but we'll move on. But we got a pool in our backyard. So we're trying to fill this. You know, it's one of those ones with the air ring in it, and we're just trying to fill it up. And you should have. I wish you could have been there with a video camera to watch as we were trying to control these two girls in the water, as there's just a little bit of water. One always wanting to sit on the ring, you know, and telling her no. And as you tell one no, what's amazing is you tell one no, the other one is getting away. This is our life right now. The other one's playing in sand, throwing sand in the pool, while the other one is sitting in the ring and then escaping and running away. And our life is defined by mayhem, chaos, craziness. But beyond that, in our lives, we also know that sometimes a story of mayhem, chaos, craziness lead us to points where it's bigger than just, you know, a frog hitting eggs or twins, you know, out of control. There are points in life where even the big events, we look at them and go, I can't make sense of this. One of our members was telling me about somebody that he knew whose family members, 28, 29 years old, are driving, and he falls asleep, and just like that, life for both of them snuffed out. You know, and we stop, we go, okay. You know, the random little things, when I say, "God, if you're really in control," but boy, when those big things hit, these massive things in our lives where we hurt, we suffer, we struggle, or we see people who even lose their lives, and we can't make sense of things. And our question this morning is literally, you know, if God is in control, why do things that are out of control seem to happen all the time? We live in a place where it just seems like it's disordered, mayhem, chaos. But then we start reading the scriptures and we find that there are all these passages about God being sovereign, about God being in control, about nothing slipping out from God's purpose and plan. And how do we make sense of that? And most of us, if you're a follower of Jesus, you've seen times where things that you look back on seem crazy, and that now, as you've matured or seasoned a little bit, you can say, "Listen, I can see the hand of God working out his purpose in my life." And theologically, the idea is called compatibilism, which basically is the idea that at the same time, God's sovereignty and our responsibility, our activity as humans are intertwined in such a way that two truths are always held up in Scripture. And the first truth is that God is sovereign over everything and works all things to the purpose for which he intends. But he does this without violating or minimizing human responsibility. That the Bible shows us that God is sovereign and that there's not one moment where God goes, oops, I didn't see that coming. God does not wake up and go, man, I was not sure what was going to happen today, and this caught me totally off guard. But we see in Scriptures that the picture of a God who already has set his purpose, his plan, and that in some way that is outside of our understanding, everything that happens in some way by our God is foreordained. And he is weaving everything into his plan, into his purpose in such a way that it is beautiful, even though we can't make sense of it sometimes. A theologian named Abraham Kuyper said, there's not a square inch in the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry, mine. This is his world, it is his creation, and he is working everything together for his purpose. Paul, one of the great writers of the Bible in the New Testament, the book of Ephesians, puts it this way. In Ephesians chapter 1, verse 11, it says, in him we have obtained an inheritance, having been predestined according to the purpose of him, and here's the phrase, who works all things according to the counsel of his will. Not some things, not a few things. He works all things according to the counsel of his will. And so on one hand, as we study the Scriptures and we read the Bible, we see that God is orchestrating the events of the world and even of our lives in such a way that there is not one thing that slips out of his control that does not ultimately get woven into the fabric of the universe for his purpose. And if we are a follower of Jesus, for our good. But on the other hand, the other side of compatibilism is that human beings are morally responsible creatures who significantly choose, they rebel, they obey, they defy love, they love, they hate, they make decisions and so forth, and they are held accountable, but their decisions never make God contingent. God is not sitting back waiting to see what we'll choose and then like playing a giant chess match. Somehow our decisions matter, but at the same time, God is sovereign. And you go, I can't make sense of that. In the Bible and in our lives, this is a mystery. This is something that takes place in the counsel of God that is bigger than us. And I will tell you over and over and over again, if we don't have places in our theology where our brain gets a headache because we go, I can't grasp this, then we are making God fit into our brain, and that's not a very big God. We have to come to points, even on issues like this, where we go, understanding the wisdom and the counsel of God and the purpose of God is outside my grasp. That doesn't mean we don't try. We just have to realize that at the end of the day, that God is bigger than this. But in the Bible, these two ideas are everywhere. And so what happens in our lives is that our lives seem totally chaotic, totally out of control, total mayhem, and we just can't make sense of things sometimes. But we got to realize that God is never caught in that situation. I remember as a kid, I'm watching my grandmother who liked to needlepoint and liked to do all the sewing stuff, and she had stuff all over the house, and you probably had a grandma who did similar thing where she was always, you know, knitting things together or you know, doing the thing where, you know, needlepoint, I guess, cross stitch, that's the name of it, cross stitches. And as she was doing a cross stitch, all you could see on her lap was the underside, and you look at that going, that's nuts, can't make sense of that. We have, one of our members brought one, and you see as they're doing a cross stitch out, and I don't know how well you could see this, but the underside, it just, there's strings everywhere. There's pieces of yarn that are sticking out. There is no order. There is no beauty in that. It's hard to figure out what's going on. And that's what you would see as they were weaving this together, as they were stitching this together. But then if you flip it to the other side, and my grandma would just flip this to the other side, all of a sudden you can see that there is a real order and a real purpose and a real design to what's going on. And it's beautiful. And see, this is what happens in our lives. We are stuck here. Our lives are lived right here. But God's has always lived right here. And while we can't necessarily look and see what's going on, the God of the universe, the Bible is trying to show us that the God of the universe is continually, nonstop, working everything according to the counsel of his will. He is accomplishing his purpose. And for those of us who know Jesus, he is doing that for our good. Now, we'll talk about what that means later, okay? But just realize that this is what's going on in Scripture. And so as I saw this question, we're in the middle of a series called Top 10 List. The idea is that we gave you the chance to raise questions, and then we let the church vote on the ones that they'd like to see us do a sermon on. And this morning, our question deals with this idea of craziness and God's sovereignty and how they interplay. I thought the best place to go for that is to a story. Because I could read you a bunch of scriptures about God's sovereignty. I could read you a bunch of scriptures about human responsibility. I could read you a bunch of scriptures about people crying out from disorder, going, God, where are you? And then God answering their prayer, I am here. And even when you can't make sense of it, you need to realize I am not out of control. But I thought we'd go to one of the great stories of the Bible to see it play out in a human life. As this guy named Joseph, at the end of his life, looks back and goes, I get it. But early in his life, it just doesn't make sense. Okay, so if you have a Bible, turn over to Genesis chapter 50. We'll be reading verses 15 to 21, but we're also going to be reading several other passages in the book of Genesis as it relates to his life. If you don't have a Bible, we'd love for you to take one. There's Bibles there at the end of your row. And if you would like to take one of those, give it as a gift or keep it for yourself, we would love to for you to do that. That is our gift to you this morning. But in Genesis chapter 50, we're at the end of this guy named Joseph's life. And some of you are familiar, like, I know this story. You kind of know where it's going. Some of you are like, I've never heard of this guy. I want to introduce you this morning to a guy named Joseph, where he fits in the biblical story and how his life and how God interacts with him is a model and a picture for us of this intertwining, this idea of God weaving the tapestry of life and of just the whole universe for his purpose, ultimately for our good. So chapter 50, beginning with verse 15. It says, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, it may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil we did to him. So they sent a messenger to Joseph saying, your father gave his command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear, I will provide for you and your little ones. Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. What happens in this passage, and we're going to hit rewind in just a minute, but what happens in this passage is that Joseph's brothers, who had done horrible evil, just to kind of give you a heads up what happens, they actually attacked him, threw him in a ditch, and then later sold him into slavery. And everything in his life is downhill from that point. Now are standing before him, and at this point in time, Joseph, because of the ordered events of his life, is now actually second in command in Egypt. And so the end of the story is really positive and really strong, but the getting there is tough. And now they're standing before him, their father has died, and they're a little bit nervous that Joseph, because of his position of power, now that their dad is dead, can get him for what they did. And they said, man, we need to come back. We kind of need to grovel at his feet because he can do whatever he wants to with us. And Joseph's response is beautiful. He says, I'm not in the place of God. And here's the deal. You meant it for evil. You meant it to harm me. You meant it to break my life up, but God was intertwined, his purpose was intertwined with your decision to do something much greater than what even you or I or anybody else could dream at the time. He meant it for good. And that is the great declaration that I'm telling you, if you are a follower of Jesus, we may not see in the short term the good. We may feel like life is totally out of control, but God is orchestrating the events of our lives to bring his ultimate purpose in us and even uses, I mean, just tons of stuff to get us there. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull out my little remote and I'm going to go back and, you know, we have a DVR, and if we watch the end of a show, there's actually a little button that can hit it and take it all the way back to the beginning. I want to take us back to the beginning. And I want to tell you about this kid named Joseph and what his life looks like in the scriptures as we see God, who sometimes seems silent, actually orchestrating every event for his purpose. And then I'm going to connect the dots and show you what that ultimate purpose is, not just with Joseph, but with all of redemption, okay? And so The story begins with a man whose name was Jacob. Jacob was kind of he was a mess, to be honest with you. Jacob was the type of guy who was just kind of a cheat. He was always causing trouble. But God eventually got a hold of Jacob's life, and Jacob ends up having 12 sons. And these 12 sons, actually four different moms. It's the weirdness of some of the things in the Old Testament where there is polygamy and just all that kind of stuff. And if you want that answered next year, you can put that on a sheet. Why does God allow polygamy? I'm not answering that today, but I'm just telling you, four different wives, 12 sons, and you can just imagine what it's like to have four women and their kids in a house. It did not go well. They were fighting all the time. It just didn't happen. And he had one wife that was favored. He had a son named Joseph who was the 11th out of 12. And because he was from the favorite wife and the youngest son and kind of the mama's boy, he loved him more than the others. And he actually gave Joseph, a symbol of all the gifts is this picture of a coat of many colors. And now we know now that God's plan in this is so that someday Donny Osmond could play this role. There's a Broadway play, Donny Osmond play. Anyway, in showing favoritism, the dad kind of sets Joseph up for a lot of animosity with his brothers. And what happens is from this point where Joseph seems to be finding favor, God and the events of life begin to work. And from this point, Joseph's life just goes downhill. Everything that happens in this story, two things take place. First of all, at every point in the story, the Bible is kind of trying to show us that Joseph actually chooses what is righteous. He actually tries to pursue God with his life and do what is good. At the same time, every event in the story, Joseph's life gets worse and worse, harder and harder, where you've got to feel the tension of God if you're really there. God, if you're really in control, why are you allowing this kid who seems to be hearing your voice and honoring you with his life, why is it that every point in the story, it seems to get worse and worse and worse for him? And so what I want to do is as we're walking through the story, I want to show you some of the factors that happen in Joseph's life that lead to his life actually spiraling downhill, his life seeming out of control, his life feeling like it's full of mayhem and craziness, and nothing is working. And as I show you each of these, we'll make some parallel to our own lives and say, sometimes this is true of us too, okay? So if you have your Bible, flip it back a few pages and find Genesis chapter 37. Genesis chapter 37, we'll begin picking up this beautiful story of the life of Joseph. Chapter 37, and we have now Joseph as a probably a teenage kid. Actually, he's 17 years old. His dad has given him this beautiful coat. His brothers kind of already despise him because he's daddy's favorite, and that just kind of gets on their nerves. All of his brothers are older. They're actually, most of them are out working fields as shepherds, kind of taking care of the sheep. And Joseph begins to hear the voice and purpose of God in his life. And the first thing that leads to Joseph's life going downhill is that he hears God speak, that God begins to speak to him. God begins to work in his life. Look at this, chapter 37, we'll begin here with verse 5. It says, Joseph had a dream. Now the text is showing us this dream, not because, he ate, some kind of bad pepperoni pizza the night before, and in the middle of the night he had a dream, and it just kind of randomly tells us. The Bible is trying to let us know that through this dream, God is speaking prophetic ideas into the life of Joseph. He is actually showing Joseph his purpose and plan. So God is speaking and says, Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, hear this dream I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field. And behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf. His brothers said to him, are you indeed to reign over us? Or are you indeed to rule over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and his words. So Joseph, in the middle of the night, he has a dream, he's sleeping, but this dream has this amazing clarity in his life. And so just thinking, hey, I know that God has spoken to me. I'm excited about what God has said. He goes out and he starts having a conversation. He tells his brothers, all right, man, here's the deal. I had this dream. You gotta check this out, guys. I had this really cool dream. And the dream was, we were all out, we were binding sheaves, meaning they were picking wheat, and now they had, strung wheat together. And now my sheaf stands up, and all your sheaves, they start bowing down to my sheaf. Well, you got to know how that goes over for his brothers. That's not a good thing. When they're already a little bit agitated that he's daddy's favorite, they also get a little annoyed with, you know, oh, you think you're hearing from God and this is what you're saying. Well, the next night he actually has another dream, and in this dream, the sun, the moon, and 12 stars actually bow down to him. And what's going on in Joseph is that he literally is having God speak into his life the ultimate purpose. I've already told you that this actually happens. But as he voices that and interacts with that and feels God working in his life, I mean, at this point, he's got to feel God is doing something really cool. I'm so excited. What a great God. And I don't quite understand this, but here's the dreams that he's just sharing it because he thinks it's beautiful. Meanwhile, the outcome is that the people around him are going, you're crazy and this is horrible and we hate you more. And see, what happens in our faith is that at some point in time, God speaks into our lives. God calls us. God works in us. And we kind of start creating this idea that when we hear all the promises and the blessings and the things in Scripture to speak of God's work in our lives, we have a tendency to take everything that feels like it's going to be good and exalting that and totally ignoring anything that deals with the life process to get there. Joseph has heard the voice of God, but God has not told him what it is going to take for Joseph to get to that point. And I just want to tell you, you need to be listening for the voice of God. God is real and he speaks. He speaks through his word. He speaks through situations. He speaks through experiences. He will speak to you. And what we all need is to cry and say, God, speak into my life. Some of us have come to that point where we literally felt the voice, the presence, the purpose of God calling us. And we fell on our knees and we repented of our sins and we gave our life to Jesus. But some of us did that at a youth camp or some event where everybody went and said, okay, because you did this, your life is going to be full of joy and everything's going to be wonderful. We got this idea of life that everything's going to be smooth sailing, the wind at our back, everything's wonderful from here on out. And you've got to see in the story of Joseph that the first step in the downhill slide is that God stepped into his life. Now, I'm not saying that at the end we see this is a reason we need to trust God. But we need to be careful that we don't create some weird theology that if I go to church, if I trust Jesus, if I live under the shadow of the cross and the purpose of God, that my life is going to be wonderful every step of the way. Sometimes the very act of trusting and following Jesus will be the thing that lead people to be against me, to have family struggles, the tension of reordering my life so I live under the purpose of God is hard sometimes. Integrating the disciplines of the Christian life. I mean, we just got to be careful that we don't create this mindset and this theology where it's smooth sailing because I've prayed a prayer and trusted Jesus. And that's Joseph. He comes out and tells a story thinking everybody's going to rejoice, and now everybody hates him more. And the second thing that happens for Joseph in the story that leads to the downhill spiral are just random events. They're just random events in life that they just kind of seem out of nowhere, and they feel totally random to us. And in Joseph's story, there's this really weird random event that just shows up in the story. His dad says, I want you to go check up on your brothers. Go find them. They're in this town not too far away. You go find them and just see how they're doing. See if they're, first of all, if they're behaving. Are they messing around and drinking all the time, just causing all kinds of troubles? Or are they just totally out of control? But also, do they need anything? Do we need to send them supplies and water? I mean, how are their lives going? Joseph, you know, you go check on them. And he goes to this town where they're supposed to be. And when he gets there, they are not there. And there's this random event, chapter 37, verses beginning with verse 18. So find that with me. Verse 18. I'm sorry, I need to back up. Chapter 37, verse 14. He says, gotta find the verse. There it is. So he said to them, go now see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock and bring me word. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron and he came to Shechem. And a man following him wandering and a man found him wandering in the fields, and the man asked him, what are you seeking? And he said, I am seeking my brothers, he said. Tell me, please, where are they pasturing their flock? And the man said, they have gone away. I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. And so Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. What happens here, this guy, we don't know anything about him. He just shows up out of nowhere. But randomly, he happened to be in a situation where he heard Joseph's brothers talking about what they needed to do. And randomly, he heard Joseph's brothers say, we're going to go take our flocks to Dothan. And then just a little while later, he just randomly happened to see Joseph wandering in the field and looking for his brothers and decided to go up and have a conversation with him. This guy just pops in, pops out, random. But the thing we got to see is that it shows up in Scripture because this random event keeps Joseph on task to find his brothers. It will eventually lead to all the downhill stuff in here. And we all have things in our lives where we look at it and at the moment we can't make sense of it, or it just seems random, or it may just be there and it doesn't seem good or bad, it just happens. And to us, it feels chaotic, random, weird. But God is orchestrating our lives for his purpose, for our good. When I was in college, I played college baseball. And while I was playing college baseball, one of the things that they want you to do is play on some team during the summer. And as I played on this, I got on this one team. It was in this one league during the summer. There's a big collegiate league here in St. Louis, but I kind of knew a guy who was on this other team. It was in a different league, and so I kind of joined that team, but it just was weird, and there were all kinds of issues, and I was like the youngest guy on the team. After my freshman year. Everybody else on the team was like in their late 20s, and it just, everything about the team just felt weird and wrong. So I just finally went to the coach. I was like, you know, this isn't for me. This is kind of a beer league for a bunch of old dudes, and I was really wanting to play for, you know, just to hone my skills, and he didn't want to play me because he wanted to play his buddies, and all that frustrated the heck out of me. And I was just like, you know, why did I end up on this team? It just felt really frustrating and weird. Well, I actually said, I'm kind of done. I'm going to quit the team. And I quit that team, and the next day, I got this phone call from this guy just out of the blue, random out of the blue phone call that said, hey, I'm a coach for this team that's in this collegiate league here in St. Louis. We actually had a pitcher get hurt, and we're kind of short, and we heard that you weren't really playing anywhere. Would you want to play with us? Now, the phone call literally came the next day, and I was like, yeah, I'll jump on board. I'll play with your team. And I jumped on this team. The team was called the Brown Group because it was sponsored by the company. And I started playing on this team. Finished out the season there, just played like 8 or 10 games. I mean, the season was almost over, but then I ended up playing with that team the next summer. And to make a really long story short, what happened is that random phone call, the being on the wrong team, the random phone call, and ending up on this Brown Group team, about like 8 out of the 15 guys of the team went to Missouri Baptist College. Well, at the end of my sophomore year, I actually went to junior college, so I had the opportunity now to choose where I was going to go again, and I had a lot of options on where I could go to school. But all the guys that I was hanging out with that were part of this team that I just kind of randomly ended up on who went to MoBAP started saying, man, come play with us. We have a really good team. You'll have a ball. It's a great place. And just kind of their persuasion of me led me to go, that's where I'm going to go to school. Well, the outcome is now I have a smoking hot wife and 5 kids. Because I went to MoBAP, just this random phone call, I ended up at this weird baseball team, and about 3 weeks into my college experience, I met Heidi. I actually got her to give me her first kiss by showing her a card trick. But not only that, what happened after playing on this team for a summer is that God called me to ministry to do what I'm doing now. He had already orchestrated the events of my life so that I could be in a place where I could train to do it. I chose MoBAP before I ever decided that I was going to be a pastor. I actually was going to be a coach and a teacher, and that was kind of the chart of my life. Could have gone anywhere to do that. But through this weird phone call out of the blue when I quit this other team, all of a sudden I'm on this team that sent my life in a trajectory that ended up with me standing before you today with the family that I have. It was a random phone call. Listen, this is our lives. Random events, we can't make sense of them, but God is always doing something, working our lives out for his purpose. All right, the third thing that happens for Joseph is not only random events and the voice of God, but sometimes sinful choices. That leads to the downfall and kind of spirals his life out of control. Chapter 37, verses 18 and 19. It says, they saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They had said to one another, here comes the dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams. And what happens here is his brothers see him, and they go, we're tired of this kid. We're tired of him being dad's favorite. We're tired of him getting all the good stuff. We're tired of his stupid dreams. We have a chance to deal with this now. And their evil, wicked hearts show up as they grab David and they throw him into a hole. And their first plan is, we're just going to kill him. We're going to knock him off. And then we're going to dip this beautiful coat of many colors in animal blood, take it back to dad and say, oh, we found this out in the middle of nowhere. Is this your son's? And then he would weep and mourn and think his son was dead and that it just happened because some animal got him. But then as they're sitting there doing this, all of a sudden this group of gypsies, it just so happened a group of gypsies show up and they go, we can actually make a little money off this deal. And they sell their brother into slavery. And this boy who had heard the voice of God, this random event, he ends up finding his brothers, and now his brothers take him, kind of beat him up a little bit, throw him in a hole, and then they sell him, and he is dragged away from his land, his country, his people, all because this wicked, evil, sinful choices of his brothers. And what happens is, you not just here, but all through the Bible, we will find that it is literally sometimes in some way, I don't understand it, that God takes the wicked, broken, evil choices that people make and he weaves them into his tapestry, not in a way that he causes the choices, but in a way that he has somehow sovereignly decreed that this is part of the way he will bring glory to himself. And sometimes it is our own choices, our own evil, our own sinfulness that leads to this. The next chapter over is an amazing story of this, where one of Joseph's brothers, a man named Judah, ends up making one horrible, sinful choice after another. The outcome is that thinking that his daughter-in-law is a prostitute, he has sex with his daughter-in-law, literally having sex with a hooker, and he gets her pregnant. It's a weird story. It's one of those, I said last week that, you know, the book of Genesis reads like a hillbilly redneck trailer park. I mean, it's one of those stories where you're just like, what's wrong with these people? They have twins. And the Bible is very, very clear to show us that Jesus is the Lion of the tribe of Judah from one of the twins that comes about from this ridiculous, sinful act. Now, I don't understand that. They end up repenting, getting right with God and with each other, and the story ends well, but man, the decisions they make, and somehow God has woven this. And even in this story, it's not Joseph. I mean, it's not Joseph's sin that leads to this. It's the sin of others. It's the sin of people around them. And what happens is somehow God weaves these things together. And when people make horrible, evil choices, somehow he weaves these things together to bring glory to himself and accomplish his purpose, even when those sinful choices, we can't make sense of them. We can't make sense of our own brokenness. We can't make sense of how people wrong us. And when it reaches the height of even horrible things, we just don't know. I was deeply, deeply grieved this week when I found out about one of our brothers that we don't know, but one of our brothers in Christ who was a follower of Jesus in Pakistan. Actually, two of our brothers who were actually brothers themselves, followers of Jesus in Pakistan. These two brothers are on either side of these other two men. I'll explain who they are in just a minute. And before I go into the story, you need to understand, and this part is for our editing. What I'm about to tell you, we're actually going to edit out of the message because I've been asked not to put anything I'm about to tell you on the internet. A lot of the material I'll tell you is actually, and I actually posted a blog that'll show up as you go home today that gives a little more detail, but some of this information they have asked us not to make it public, only make public for public consumption the things that are commonly known. His name is Rashid Emmanuel. He got accused falsely in Pakistan of violating their blasphemy laws. He got accused. Somebody signed his name to a pamphlet that said bad things about Muhammad. And what happens with this law in Pakistan is that when people get arrested, they literally are brought to trial and usually found innocent, but then that gives reason in that culture to get the guy. And that's what happened this week. These two men, the two brothers, planting churches, helping people, living the gospel, in cold blood as they came out of the courthouse in shackles, were gunned down. And they are now part of the fiber, the group of martyrs who have given their lives for the cause of Jesus. You know, some of the things that I read about this said, you know, as they talked about Rashid and his brother and the stuff that's going on, they knew the potential cost to them living out the gospel there. Now, we sit here and we see this, and we go, man, that's horrible, that's terrible, that's brutal. A first century church father said this: it is the blood of the martyrs that is the seed of the church. And what this first early second century person said actually has been the truth that has rung out through all church history. As evil people take the lives of good people who living out the gospel, what has taken place inevitably in these places is that the gospel spreads and people come to faith in Jesus and the church grows. And even he weaves the wicked, horrible choices that people make into this. And while I'm grieved, I know that one of the potential outcomes of suffering of our brothers and sisters in Pakistan is that God will grow his church and people will find Jesus as a result of their suffering. And God even uses the wicked, evil choices of people. He does it in Joseph's life. He does it elsewhere. Another thing that God uses is even our right choices. And for the story of Joseph, really quick, what happens is that he ends up in slavery in Egypt. He is living in this house where a guy named Potiphar is is the leader of the home. And Joseph, God is with Joseph, and Joseph's experience in Potiphar's house is that everything goes well and that everything Joseph does, everything Joseph touches, is involved with, it prospers. And Potiphar picks up on this and basically exalts Joseph to his leader in his home, and that he says, listen, anything in my house is yours except my wife. Well, then he goes away on business as one of the leaders of Pharaoh's armies, and as he's away on business, Potiphar's wife sees Joseph and thinks, dude, you look good. You are hot. I am into you. And starts flirting with him and basically saying, listen, I'll keep it quiet. Nobody will ever know. You and I can sleep together when he's away. And then when he comes back, we'll just act like nothing's going on. And we can just kind of go on and have a great time together. And Joseph basically continues to put away her advances and to make wise choices, to make godly choices, to make righteous choices. And the outcome eventually is that as Joseph says, I will honor God with my life. I will live for the glory of God. I cannot do this. She begins to get angry and jealous and eventually corners him, puts him in a situation where he escapes, and literally she rips the robe off of his back and then makes a claim that he tried to rape her to her husband. Her husband gets angry, furious with him, and the right choices, the godly, the wise choices that Joseph makes, ends him in prison. The downward spiral just continues as Joseph keeps trying to honor God, making good choices. Well, not only the right choices, but also hardship and suffering. And the last thing we find in Joseph is that he is in a very hard place. And in chapter 39, go ahead and flip over there, there's a very interesting phrase that talks about after Joseph had put away the advances and this event happened. Chapter 39, verse 21. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. What basically takes place here is we see this. We go, man, how can this? It just feels so random. It feels so disconnected. And now Joseph is suffering. He's in prison. You know, prisons back then were not good. And as he's in prison, he's got to be going, why? I can't make sense of this. But he continues to honor God with his life, and the outcome is that we see that God is with Joseph, that God is working in his life, and he even puts him in a place of leadership in prison. Eventually, two men have dreams, and they're thrown in prison. They're thrown in prison by Pharaoh. They have these dreams, and they come to Joseph, and they ask Joseph to interpret the dreams. And Joseph does. And for one, it means, hey, you're going to be put back in a position you were with Pharaoh. The other one, it means he's going to lift up your head and lop it off. One guy has a favorable, but once again, God is speaking to Joseph through dreams. He tells the guy who's going to go back, he says, don't forget me. He does. And Joseph spends another year in prison for something that he didn't really do. And he suffers in its hardship. But the story eventually goes that there is a point in time where Pharaoh has a dream. And when Pharaoh has a dream, he is troubled because he knows that God is speaking to him. But he can't find anybody. And the baker remembers, oh yeah, that kid, that guy I knew back in prison, he knew dreams. And eventually Joseph gets cleaned up and stands before the very king of Egypt, Pharaoh, and is able to interpret his dreams. And the dreams that Pharaoh had, God was speaking into Pharaoh's life, showing him that he was going to send 7 years of good produce, and that the land was going to have great years where the crops would be really good, and then 7 years of famine. And Joseph interprets the dream. He kind of gives the Pharaoh a plan for how to get ready for this, how to prepare. And ultimately, the king hears that Joseph has the heart of God and that he is a person of integrity and he is a leader. And he puts Joseph in the place where he is his right-hand man, who becomes basically the secretary of agriculture and oversees this whole process where for 7 years they begin to store up food so that when the next 7 years comes, they will have food. It is that very reason when the famine hits that his brothers run out of food and have to come back to Egypt, and they end up before Joseph. And Joseph does some really interesting things as he tests their heart. But at the end, he is reunited with his brothers, and his brothers and his family are saved from a famine. Not only his brothers and his family, but the whole world around them are saved from a horrible 7-year famine that is in the hands and purpose of God, because Joseph heard the voice of God, had this random event, end up running into his brothers, and they made horrible choices. And Joseph made the right choice when he was confronted, and it's all downhill. And he suffered greatly, all because God was orchestrating the events of his life so that he would end up there. And as he ended up there, the outcome is that Joseph's tribe becomes a nation. God delivers them from slavery in Egypt, and the deliverance from slavery in Egypt is the backdrop of the entire Bible as we see God intervening and working in the lives of his people. And that story shows us, we see it disordered, random, we're stuck in the middle, we see the bottom side of the tapestry. God is at work orchestrating the events of our lives for our good, for his glory. And so the question is, why? And the answer is because God is a God of great purpose. There's a great passage that kind of gives us the conclusion of this. And I just want to look at it real quick. In Romans chapter 8, verses 28 through 30, flip over to that passage, page 809. And not only flip over to it, I would encourage you to put your thumb in it, hold it, learn this. The reason, instead of just showing it to you on the screens, I want you to fold the corner of this in your Bible, mark it. This whole chapter speaks to this issue, but I want to hear what he says here. Chapter 8, verses 28 through 30, he says, "And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. For those who before knew, he also predestined to be conformed in the image of his son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those whom he predestined, he also called. And those whom he called, he also justified. And those whom he justified, he also glorified." God, Paul says, as he's writing this, those who love God, all things work together for good. And now, we tend to read that and go, but my life stinks right now. Where's the good? And we want to see life like we are a cup that God is going to fill up. And that good means that somehow eventually my life is going to be hunky-dory, breezy, wonderful, it's all going to work, all that kind of stuff. But that's not what Paul's getting at. We need to redefine what it means that God works for our good. You and I were created in the image of God. Our problem is not that we are cups that need to be filled by God. We are created in the image of God, but because of our sinfulness, our freedom, our responsibility, we are now broken. In fact, rather than seeing ourselves as a cup that needs to be filled up, Mark Driscoll in his book Doctrine says we need to quit seeing ourselves as a cup that needs to be filled by God, and we need to begin seeing ourselves as a mirror that is broken. And that is, ooh, I can even do this and have a little fun with you, so you have to be in the lights a little bit. That's great. Woo-hoo. We are a mirror, but as a mirror, we are broken and not reflecting the right thing, and that what good in our life, this is what Paul's getting at. He says, all things work together for good. Well, what is good? For whom he foreknew, he also predestined, and here's the phrase, to become conformed into the image of his son. Our good is when we are as a broken mirror, reformed and then adjusted so that we reflect the goodness of God. That is why God created us. That is our good. And in doing this, God is preparing us not only for joy here, but for heaven, for our eternal existence. We are not crying out to God, fill me. We need to cry out to God, reshape me and adjust me so that I reflect your glory. And it is the stuff that happens in Joseph's life that God uses to do that very thing. It's the stuff that he uses ours. So the question, why is my life out of control? It is. That's not going to get solved, but God is orchestrating the events of our lives for his glory, for our good. So what's our response to that? It's to continually trust him. Continually say, Jesus, I know you died for me, and I run to you. I don't get it, I run to you. I can't make sense of this, I run to you. I will trust you. I'm going to close my sermon this morning, our time here in my message, with a time where you get to pray. Because what happens, we come to these and we go, this is our life. So what do you do with it? And we have a prayer that we've designed. We're just going to put up here on the screen. So it kind of goes back to the beginning where we had a little fun jumping up and down. I just want you for a minute to silently sit there, interact with the prayer on the screens, and let this be the cry of your heart, okay? Okay.